It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you. About living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in their hands. Watching us close, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
Hello and welcome to Singola and Friends. It is Thursday, August 27th, 2015. This is Deanna Spingola broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. Please visit SpingolaSpeaks.net to access the audio files of my programs. This site was created and is maintained by a friend and listener. There is a tab at the top titled Your Health Matters, which is a comprehensive list of external websites. He also has a wonderful list of Kindle books that have been written by my guests. I hope that you will order your Amazon books via this list. Please also visit screeningsandyhook.net, a website created by the same person. I invite the listeners to subscribe to SpingolaSpeaks.net. By subscribing, one will receive an email announcing the addition of new program audio files. One may, without charge, listen to the archives of all of my programs and make comments. Please also visit my website, spingola.com, to see the guest schedule for my radio programs, including dates, times, and call-in numbers, plus information about my four books. During the program, email your questions or comments to comment@spingola.com. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website, spingola.com, or by visiting spingola.chatango.com. You may call into the program with questions or comments at 646-787-1915. But please wait until I open the phone lines. Again, that telephone number is 646-787-1915. My Twitter account is twitter.com/Deanna Spingola. Let me just say a few words about yesterday's shooting. Roanoke TV station's employees, Allison Parker and Adam Ward, were killed in an on-air shooting. The estimated population of the United States as of August 15th was 321,522,000. There are 78,694,222 people taking psych drugs in the United States. That means that about 25% of the entire population is on psych drugs. One of the Fox News commentators had a doctor on his program yesterday, and her conclusions were that Americans need more mental health care, and then these shootings would not occur. It is absolutely irresponsible to ignore the influence that psych drugs have in the thousands of individual suicides and the mass shootings that have occurred in the last three decades. Authorities who refuse to investigate drugs as a factor are either intensely indoctrinated or are duplicitous with the corporate media and the campaign fund-seeking congressional cabal in Washington. People on psych drugs can commit terrible, atrocious, evil acts, whether they are actively taking these chemical lobotomizing drugs or whether they are withdrawing from them. Some of the SSRI side effects include, and SSRI drugs are, well, they're very, very popular. The side effects include abdominal pain, akathisia, all over body pain, anxiety, decreased sex drive, diarrhea, dizziness, drowsiness, dry mouth, restlessness, insomnia, social disinhibitions, impulsivity, agitation, emotional numbness, fatigue, flu-like symptoms, headache, hot flashes, impotence, indigestion, insomnia, irritability, loss of appetite, nausea, neck/jaw pain, nervousness, numbness, pins and needles feelings, rapid heartbeat, shakiness, slow heartbeat, suicide and homicide ideation, sweating, tiredness, lack of energy, weakness, and weight gain. Okay, with all of those side effects, we are going to have, we're going to have people demonstrating their side effects against the population. And remember, 25% of the entire population is on psych drugs. And of course, the objective of psychiatry is to get the other 75% onto these lobotomizing drugs. Okay, today I'm going to talk a bit about Governor George W. Bush, Connecticut's native son. Now you might think, oh, come on, that's old news. What does Bush have to do with what's going on today? But we always have to look at history because history is a prologue. And if you know what happened in history, then you can kind of get an idea of what's going on contemporarily. Okay. Bush announced his candidacy for the Texas governorship on November 8, 1993, with a campaign based on self-reliance and personal responsibility rather than dependence on the government. George H.W. Bush and his son, George W., promoted the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, which was approved under Clinton, which took effect on January 1, 1994. This weakened American and Canadian environmental laws and further exacerbated the wretched conditions in Mexico, where the peso crashed. Wages in Mexico sank by 29%. Congressional bribery for NAFTA via pork barrel promises cost the taxpayers $50 billion. By 1997, American job losses amounted to about 394,835, mostly women, blacks, and Hispanics. The figure would increase to 600,000 by January 1, 1999. With Karl Rove's genius, which included compassionate conservatism, religious rhetoric, and strategized staging, and huge corporate contributions, because there's no campaign limits in Texas, George W. Bush was elected Texas's first Republican governor, and he served in that, he functioned in that position from 1995 to 2000, and it was the first Republican governor since Reconstruction. Campaign wizardry diverted voter focus to moral issues, which is not the government's business. Bush said he was humbled and honored that so many people responded to his message, no matter how fake it was. Ken Lay and Enron attorney Joe B. Allen were Bush's top fundraisers and would be Bush's top corporate contributors in 2000 when he ran for the presidency. Thomas Hicks of HM Capital Partners, LLC, had donated $146,000 to Bush's gubernatorial campaigns. Richard Rainwater had donated $100,000. Hicks paid lobbyists as much as $110,000 to enact legislation to create the University of Texas Investment Management Company, which was called UTIMCO, which was a public-private partnership, privatizing the university's abundant financial assets of $13 billion. Hicks was already on the Board of Regents due to his contributions to Governor Ann Richards. He gave Bush a belated $25,000, for which Governor Bush appointed him chairman. Other board members had contributed between $7,000 and $141,000 to the Bush gubernatorial campaign. Now, under Thomas Hicks' direction and without any public oversight whatsoever, he diverted $525 million into crony corporations, including the Carlyle Group, Maverick Capital Fund, and which had donated $210,000 to Bush's gubernatorial campaigns. Other monies went to Bass Brothers Enterprises, which had also financed Bush in his run for the governor. They also financed Harkin Oil's Bahrain venture to the tune of about $215,000. Other monies went to the corporation Kohlberg Kravis Roberts, and they joined Hicks in a $1.5 billion takeover of Regal Cinemas. Evercore Partners, which joined Hicks in a $900 million buyout of television stations. American Securities Partners received Utimco funds several months after selling 11 radio stations to Hicks. Co-founders, so what they were doing, they took the university's money, $13 billion, and they just funneled it off to these corporations that happened to give a lot of money to Bush for his gubernatorial campaign. That's how politics works, folks. You pay to get somebody in, and then you're rewarded, immensely. And, of course, they did this private, public-private collaboration, and there you have all that money, the $13 billion, going into your favorite corporation. Now, one of those corporations was, of course, the Carlyle Group. Co-founders Stephen Norris and David Rubenstein founded the Carlyle Group in 1987 at the Carlyle Hotel, situated by Central Park. Carlyle Partners II, the Defense Contractors Fund, got $10 million from Utimco. How handy. George H.W. Bush was also associated with the Carlyle Group, and because of his previous political status, helped the group attract deep-pocketed investors. Hicks possibly received sufficient management fees through these investments to enable his 1998 purchase of the Texas Rangers for $250 million. All assets, public or private, are vulnerable to politically facilitated transfers into corporate coffers. In addition to funneling Utimco money to cronies, the Texas Teachers Retirement System, TRS, which managed the pension fund, which was over $100 billion, and it was for the state's 800,000 public school teachers, was also targeted for Bush cronies. On September 5, 1995, Bush appointed Ronald G. Steinhardt of Dallas as the presiding officer for TRS. So, the political leader just goes ahead after his election and appoints his buddies to preside over these huge, huge funds. And, that's a lot of money, $113 billion. Just sitting there waiting for somebody to come along and exploit it, use it up. Regarding the funneling of pension funds, the FBI discovered that former Connecticut State Treasurer Paul J. Sylvester, 2 months before leaving office in November 1998, after his reelection defeat, made a $50 million investment in Carlyle Asia using the Connecticut State Pension Fund. Pension funds is a very interesting topic, which is we don't have time to talk about it today, and I don't know enough about them to talk about other radio programs. Clint Richardson, for one, that can talk very well about pension funds. Anyway, Sylvester invested $800 million of that pension fund in various private equity firms for which he received kickbacks. Though the FBI investigated, no one pressed charges. Carlyle finally disclosed the finder's fee that it paid to Wayne Berman, one of George W. Bush's key financial backers. Sylvester told the media that he had done nothing irregular in making those investments. However, this situation compelled him to resign from his new position at the investment company Park Strategies, owned by Berman, who reported that Sylvester resigned for personal reasons, quote unquote. Officials sealed many documents from the case. However, the Hartford Courant gained access to court documents that revealed that Sylvester understood that his employment opportunity with Berman and or substantial salary was contingent upon his investing Connecticut state pension money with Carlisle. The Courant reported that because of Sylvester's investment with Carlisle, Berman received almost $1 million from Carlisle as a finder's fee for the $100 million derived from the Connecticut State Pension Fund. Additionally, in January 2000, the Associated Press reported that the Connecticut State Treasurer's Office had paid Carlisle Europe Partners $2,971,945 for some unknown purpose. Harper's Magazine article, Notes on a Native Son, reported on George W. Bush's campaign and his close association with corporate interests. The Carlisle Group had a great deal of influence over Bush. One could easily claim that Bush owed his presidency to two people, his father and James Baker III, who also assisted Bush Sr. to become president. Both Bush Sr. and Baker were deeply involved in the Carlisle Group, as was Donald Rumsfeld, who was CEO of G.D. Searle. In 1997, Governor George W. Bush supported mental health parity, which was titled the Patient's Bill of Rights, that required private industry to provide increased insurance coverage for mental health treatment, including mental health drugs. Now, you can, of course, compare this to what is occurring with the Affordable Health Care Act. It is also similar to the Mental Health Parity Act, MHPA, that President Bill Clinton signed on September 26, 1996, applicable to group health plans beginning on or after January 1, 1999. MHPA, which is Mental Health Parity Act, and similar legislation requires insurers to cover mental health care, which increased access to treatment. And if treatment means psych drugs. It does not mean talk therapy. It means drugs. Medicare, state-assisted Medicaid, and employer-provided insurance have some dire consequences. The costs are often so high that the states have insufficient funds to revamp failing infrastructure. Manufacturers move their production offshore to avoid paying what amounts to extra labor costs. NAFTA, which I mentioned previously, which was promoted by both Bushes, George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, they both pushed NAFTA, which coincided very well with the mental health care, with all of the insurance, the farces, what they were trying to get. Well, they were actually funneling money into Big Pharma. So manufacturers moved their production offshore to avoid what amounts to extra labor cost. NAFTA was also a factor, essentially an economic assault on America, which, of course, started in 1994. Then, in 1997, the mental health legislation mandate, applicable even to smaller firms with only 25 to 49 employees, increased business costs. The Kaiser Family Foundation, the KFF, conducted a study on the effect of the mental health mandate on firms according to size. It extracted data per capita from the National Institute of Mental Health, Blue Cross Blue Shield Industry Association, and the Employment Benefit Research Institute. KFF evaluated firms having 3 to 9 employees, 10 to 24 employees, 25 to 49, or 50 to 199 employees, and large firms having 200 to 999 employees. KFF thought that all firms would assume 75% of the cost, whether the firm had less than 20 or as many as 500 employees, who would pay 25%. Additionally, 60% of the firms with 10 employees offered health insurance in 2000 and would continue to do so. The percentage of small employers that offered health insurance was from 55% in the retail trade to 93% in manufacturing. With mandated mental health care, the compliance rates decreased as the cost increased to an average of $1,558 for each worker in manufacturing and $1,118 for each worker in construction, mining, and agricultural services. Approximately 65 to 100% of the firms complied with regular health insurance, while about 40 to 80% complied with the mental health mandate. These mandates increased job losses. All sectors of the economy experienced unemployment, more especially in the retail trade. Meanwhile, due to the mental health mandate, there was an increase in health services, a yearly increase from 2,000 to 7,000 jobs. Compliance million dollars from the country's economy to compensate for the health mandate, the health care mandate, just in the first year, and $40 million in the second year. There were also income and purchasing power losses in retail and construction, which greatly contributed to unemployment in those areas. Consumers and businesses, because of the mental health mandate, had nearly $200 million lot less to spend per year. One must also consider the average regulatory cost of about $7,000 per worker given the number of fewer employees. Evidence shows that following the 1996 Health Care Parity Act, cost increased by 3 to 6% for some health care plans. Consequently, about 2.4 million employees lost their health insurance. This came at a time when the workforce was aging, and some claimed that this group of people needed mental health care benefits, and someone will have to pay for those benefits. With so many people then demanding a benefit that they had previously had, someone would have to assume the cost, which were now increasing. Further, those who worked for very small firms, burdened with mandates and regulations, would not have health insurance. In 2007, American citizens spent $2.3 trillion on health care. That's 4.3 times the amount spent on national defense. The United States spends 16% of its gross domestic product on health care, more than any other country. Yet, America has more sick people than any other country. In the purely symptom-oriented way of managing most chronic illnesses, healthcare costs are spiraling out of control. These health expenditures now pose the greatest threat to the survival of the economy. Corporations are unable to expand and pay for their employees' health insurance and are forced to decrease the number of employees. Lose the idea that elected officials serve the public interest. Most politicians are corporate courtesans. Voters determine nothing. Corporate checkbooks dictate. The pharmaceutical industry made massive donations to Bush's presidential campaign. Without money from drug makers, HMO executives, lobbyists, and other pharmaceutical interests, he never would have taken office. In 2000, the following industries contributed to Bush. The drug companies contributed $10,074,000. Real estate, $3,661,372. Construction, $3,472,821. Agribusiness, $2,148,624. Gas and oil, $1,463,799. And automotive, $1,019,581. For a total of $21,840,197, about half of it coming from the drug industry. Eli Lilly donated $1.6 million to Bush and the Republican Party. And this is not a partisan issue, okay? It doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. Both parties cater to Big Pharma. Don't kid yourself. By the time that Bush made it to the White House, the Carlyle Group, whose history includes CIA ties, had interest in numerous defense companies through its buyouts and had made various arms deals and enjoyed corporate cronyism. Carlyle was the biggest beneficiary in the largest increase in defense spending in history. Bush filled his administration with Carlyle associates, employees, friends, and business partners, including James Baker as his Secretary of State. In 2002, the United States purchased 45.5% of all global weapons and war-related services from companies that Carlyle acquired. Let me reread that. In 2002, right before the second invasion of Iraq, 2002, the United States purchased 45.5% of all global weapons and war-related services from companies that Carlyle had acquired. The 2004 military budget amounted to $400 billion, twice as much as all of the NATO nations combined, more than the military buildup during Ronald Reagan's administration in the 1980s. The Carlyle Group privately held portfolio included United Defense, BDM, Vinell, V-I-N-N-E-L-L, U.S. Investigations Services, Corporate Structures, EG&G, Federal Data Corporation, Lear Siegler, and Voight Aircraft. Richard Perle was chair of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board and also had major investments and Middle East war preparations. That's how the socially incestuous tit-for-tat ruling class elite obtain power, exploit public funds, and confiscate land and other resources. Corporate cronyism allotted Bush, the crown prince of privatization, the largest presidential war chest in American history, at least $117 million for 2000, due to bundling, a tactic for circumventing federal election campaign limits. This was in addition to what each of the parties raised. Okay, so the Bushes are all very heavily invested in Carlyle and made millions, if not billion, from the invasion of Iraq. Okay, let me just check the chat room real quick. See if there are any questions or comments. Yes, Bushies, etc., milk pension funds to the tune of billions during this week's Black Monday. Yes, of course. They know exactly how to play the market and game the system. Okay, now we're going to find out how Bush... What did he do for Texas? And this is called What's Good for Texas is Good for the Country, the TMAP model of mental health. Under Governor Bush, the Texas Department of Mental Health and Mental Retardation, that's TDMHMR, the University of Texas Southwestern, and the Mental Health and Corrections Systems of Texas accepted the marketing proposals of several pharmaceutical companies for what became the Texas Medication Algorithm Project, TMAP, initiated in late 1997. The NIM, that's the National Institute of Mental Health, the NIMH, the Department of Veterans Affairs, also participated. So we have the drug companies, several agencies within Texas, and Veteran Affairs and the National Institute of Mental Health participated in TMAP. A medical algorithm is a clinical-free computation formula statistical review or table devised for healthcare personnel. Algorithms allow a healthcare professional to select a treatment protocol based on symptoms without considering the foundational cause of those symptoms. In other words, if A, B, and C are evident, then the doctor may simply select drug treatment C and then move quickly on to the next patient. TMAP was not the first algorithm project of its type proffered. In 1991, Dr. David N. Osser and Dr. Robert T. Patterson started the Harvard Psychopharmacology Algorithm Project. Its objective was to improve the quality of care through the promotion of evidence-based medicine using computerized algorithms. The two psychiatrists who wanted to speed the adoption of best research evidence and into day-to-day treatment of patients created algorithms for bipolar depression, bipolar mania, PTSD, schizophrenia, social anxiety disorder, and psychotic depression. Osser, associated with the APA, that's the American Psychiatric Association, from which he has won awards, is on the editorial boards of the Journal of Clinical Psychopharmacology, International Drug Therapy Newsletter, which was renamed Psychopharm Review, and Psychiatric Times. So this guy is very well connected. The Harvard group, now composed of several psychiatrists, said, and I quote, "The most effective treatment modality for inpatients with severe psychotic depression is electroconvulsive therapy. The first time psychopharmacological treatment is a combination of an antidepressant, either a tricyclic or a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, that's SSRI, and an antipsychotic." Okay, so let's electrify them and then give them a bunch of, well, an antidepressant and an antipsychotic, whatever they need. Let's just fill them up, wonderful, wonderful drugs, after we shock them. Janssen Pharmaceutica, which operates a specialty sales division devoted to public sector marketing. Now, keep in mind that marketing is the essential way that people, that the companies, particularly since 1997, because in 1997, the FDA approved of direct-to-consumer marketing. And so the pharmaceutical companies have become very, very expert at marketing their product. And it's certainly Madison Avenue expertise all the way. Anyway, Janssen Pharmaceutica led the following drug companies in selecting the most accommodating state in developing, financing, and or directly creating the marketing of the medication algorithm project. Okay, the following companies were involved: Johnson & Johnson, Eli Lilly, AstraZeneca, Pfizer, Novartis, Janssen Ortho McNeil, Glaxo, SmithKline, Abbott, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Wyeth Ayers Forest Laboratories, and U.S. Pharmacopoeia. Janssen Pharmaceutica aggressively developed the medication algorithm project model, which necessitates compromising and influencing public officials. That's a quote. Compromising and influencing public officials, quote unquote, by bypassing, and I quote, governmental safeguards, unquote. The firms listed above financed the creation of the TMAP model that would exclusively utilize the drugs manufactured by the funding companies, including Risperdal, Zyprexa, Seroquel, Geodon, Depakote, Paxil, Zoloft, Celexa, Wellbutrin, Zyban, Remerin, Zyrzone, Effexor, Buspar, Adderall, and, of course, Prozac. Alan Jones, a whistleblower employed by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania Office of Inspector General, the OIG, stated, and I quote, "Drug industry money guided TMAP from conception through development and expansion to other states. The growth of TMAP began with misleading science. It grew and expanded with the aid of compromised public officials at all level of our government. The industry was influencing state officials with trips, perks, lavish meals, transportation to, and first-class accommodations in major cities. Some state employees were paid honorariums of up to $2,000 for speaking in their official capacities at drug company-sponsored events. Drug companies, that's unquote. Drug companies, perhaps using a professional facilitator, may have maneuvered the consensus of a small group of politically appointed health officials in various states who, ignoring all existing state safeguards, accepted and instituted the TMAP treatment model for their state. Hey, you put your hand out, the drug companies are going to fill it up with greenbacks or with money or any other thing you want. The pharmaceutical industry found that Texas, a highly political as well as a Republican state, was, and I quote, uniquely suited for a marketing scheme, quote unquote, like TMAP. The industry, to legitimize its objectives, acquired political influence. Jones said that in Washington, D.C., in 1997, there were 1,662 registered lobbyists representing 2,034 clients who earned $210 million and spent many millions more to influence those legislators, unquote. Amongst those lobbyists, many of them represented drug companies and used those millions to purchase power. In 2014, there were 1,300 lobbyists who primarily represent the healthcare and pharmaceutical industries. That is more than per legislator. Just through July 2014, Eli Lilly and Company spent $4,056,000 procuring the patronage of elected officials who are supposed to be maintaining and defending the interest of their constituents. In the Texas legislature, there are 31 senators and 150 representatives, all of whom earned $7,500. That was during the session. They met every other year for 140 days, during which most of them signed bills they do not bother to read or understand. And of course, they, for those 140 days that they served, they earned a certain amount of money each day. Therefore, because they didn't bother to read the bills or to try to understand them, they just signed them. Therefore, they were open to outside guidance. They had the power of the purse. The other factors that made for a suitable, susceptible state were the presence of politically controlled universities, well-populated prisons, state hospitals, and the juvenile justice system. Texas has nearly 150,000 people warehoused prisons and correction and detention facilities, more than any other state. Texas also had its share of well-financed lobbyists who easily persuaded the legislators to adopt and authorize legislation that would make them look efficient in delivering beneficial health programs to the Texas citizens. TMAP recruited patients, quote unquote, from the prison system and the state hospital. Medicaid or Medicare would pick up the cost for the drugs. Ohio implemented the TMAP model in 1999. In 2002, Ohio spent $145 million in Medicaid, for patients participating in a similar program. The patients were prescribed drugs for schizophrenia, whether they had it or not. So, just so you understand, that Medicaid, the states have to come up, they have to pay part of the Medicaid fees, the cost. Okay, with TMAP and TCMAP already in place, and that was the one in California, I believe in California, already in place, Johnson & Johnson awarded grant money, $300,000 for another program, the Texas Implementation of Medication Algorithms Project, TIMAP, a method to introduce and expand the TMAP and TCMAP to other states. Janssen and other drug companies funded the expansion. By 2002, 10 states were on board with TMAP. Janssen also financed the new research committee of the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. Dr. Sean, a co-director of TMAP, wrote reports and articles for, well, several agencies. And these KOLs praise TMAP and its treatments. Okay. In 2003, excuse me, California, which calls its program California Medication Algorithm Project, okay, CalMAP, spent more than $500 million through Medicaid just on the atypicals, which include Risperdal, Zyprex, and Seroquel. Beginning in 500 million through Medicaid for three drugs, Risperdal, Zyprex, and Seroquel. That is money that could have gone elsewhere, but was funneled into the pharmaceutical corporations that make those three drugs. Beginning in 1996, the following states, besides Texas, initiated a medication algorithm project: California, Colorado, Nevada, Illinois, Kentucky, New Mexico, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Maryland, Missouri, and Washington, D.C. Various states implemented the depression and bipolar algorithms in addition to algorithms for children. Now, at about the same time, in 1997, the FDA approved of the of a policy that would allow drug experimentation for children. The FDA approved of this. This occurred under Clinton, and I talked about it in a previous program when I subbed for Clint Richardson. But the FDA, what a they are totally, totally in bed with the corporations. Don't expect them to protect your rights or to protect your health. They sold you out a long time ago. Okay, Jones defined some of the issues Pennsylvania's OIG chose to overlook. Janssen Pharmaceutica may have violated AMA and FDA guidelines, Federal Health and Human Services, OIG guidelines, and federal anti-kickback laws in that, number one, Janssen made direct payments of money to state officials for representing Janssen products. The remuneration was far in excess of reasonable value, such as $2,000 for a half-day presentation, and was made to officials who were in a position to influence the state drug formulary. Now, keep in mind that this is applicable to any state official. to any state attorney general. I mean, it's just apply this to any official in any state, that pharmaceutical companies can make direct payments of money. And nobody's going to, despite the fact that it violates all these laws, all these guidelines, it does not matter. Money speaks. Number two, Janssen provided trips, entertainment, and meals directly to the persons who were in key positions to accept or reject Janssen's product in the state formulary. Number three, Janssen influenced to the point of control the content and materials in which Janssen had provided educational grant funding. Number four, Janssen selected speakers for educational grant-funded symposiums and paid travel expenses and honorariums to those speakers. Janssen, through these symposiums and through direct contact with Pennsylvania officials, encouraged doctors to prescribe drugs in dosages that were not FDA approved. But, you know, drug dealers do that all the time. Drug dealers, meaning people who sell drugs for pharmaceutical companies. They visit the doctors and they encourage, with trips and perks and all kinds of things, they encourage those doctors to prescribe our products. And that's what, so doctors are involved in this, well, throughout the country. Number six, Janssen. Okay, number seven. No, number six. Janssen, through these symposiums and through direct contact with Pennsylvania officials, encouraged doctors to prescribe medications for non-FDA approved indications. And that, of course, is off-label marketing, which I've talked about before, off-label prescribing. In other words, if somebody comes in with a soccer injury, that doctor could prescribe Seroquel for a soccer injury. Somebody, a friend of mine, told me a gentleman told me that his former girlfriend's daughter, who was 16, got hurt playing soccer. She went to the doctor, and the doctor prescribed Seroquel. She committed suicide within a week. That's off-label. Off-label prescription. Okay, number eight. Janssen funded travel and expenses for Commonwealth employees to represent Janssen in the employees' official state capacity. Wow. Janssen's cooperation with other drug manufacturers, number nine, Janssen's cooperation with other drug manufacturers in the advancement of TMAP has clear antitrust and racketeering implications. In addition to the drug company impropriety, the OIG had solid evidence that employees, in addition to Fiorello, had engaged in the same conduct. Yet Fiorello was the only one investigated and recommended for prosecution. That was somebody that they targeted. He was probably a whistleblower. Because of TMAP and TCMAP, the Texas Medicaid program was bankrupt by early 2001, as were the budgets of the state's mental health and prison system. Yeah, all that money went to the drug companies. The state was paying more for psychiatric medication than for any other type, and the number of patients were increasing. State mental hospitals and prisons have a continuous movement of institutionalized individuals who receive treatment while in those facilities, leave with prescriptions, and continue the same treatment following their release, paid for by Medicaid or Medicare. The prison system especially functions as, and I quote, a patient recruitment and retention, unquote, pharma. the drug companies promoted. Because remember that a lot of these drugs are addictive. So I get so upset when I talk about this stuff. The drug companies promoted their innovative patented medications as, and I quote, safer and more effective than the older generic brand. The drug reps and lobbyists claimed that the new drugs treated the symptoms of mental illness, quote unquote, but without the troublesome side effects often seen with conventional medications. What a big fat lie. The reps also told the legislators that doctors working for the state, those servicing the state hospitals and prisons, must select the newest, and I quote, the newest, most expensive drugs patented by the pharmaceutical companies in the treatment of their patients. They were free to choose from among those specified drugs and could not use the cheaper generics unless the more expensive drug failed. Texas lawmakers enlarged Medicaid to cover previously unqualified individuals so that they could acquire mental health drugs. Then they increased the budget to pay for those drugs for individuals within the Texas mental health and prison systems. Bush, in favor of GMAP and an increased budget, asked for even more money. $67 million for additional mental health drugs for fiscal year 2000 to 2001 for the Texas prison and mental health system. In 1995, Texas had implemented TMAP in the prison system, the juvenile justice system, and in the state mental health hospitals, which benefited the pharmaceutical firms and their most expensive drugs. TMAP was an alliance of those specific drug firms, the Texas State University, and the mental health and corrections system. They're all working together. Johnson & Johnson, the owners, Janssen Pharmaceutica and Janssen/Ortho-McNeil, provided an initial grant of $1.7 million from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Now, whenever you see on TV advertisements talking about Johnson & Johnson, They say, the family company. Oh, right. To legitimize TMAP, the drug companies hired psychiatrists similar to the individuals who devised the various disorders for the DSM. That's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, to decide which drugs would be appropriate to use. The psychiatrists did not employ hard evidence, review case studies or clinical trials, but just offered their opinions, most likely based on their numerous financial ties with several of the drug companies. It seems that a consensus, rather than science, is behind voluminous decisions that affect a lot of very trusting people. The expert consensus, quote unquote, method was TMAP's standard for creating the facade of authority for the specific drugs it utilized from 1996 to 2003. The drug companies selected doctors who had already established a name through their published articles in which they advocated the newest drugs. These doctors, often referred to as key opinion leaders, had strong connections to the drug industry, and they included Dr. Jack Gorman, who had resigned from a top position at New York's Psychiatric Institute after a newspaper article divulged that he had accepted over $140,000 from drug firms from April 1, 1997 to March 31, 1998. 11 months. Gorman also received speaking fees, travel, board memberships, and consulting fees from Janssen, Johnson & Johnson, Eli Lilly, and Pfizer. He received $12,000 from Pfizer while he was conducting a research project for Pfizer. The stories are pretty much the same for the other 12 researchers who were profiting from drug company payoffs, including the head of the Psychiatric Institute's Patient Protection Panel. The Institute had conducted Prozac experiments on children without telling the parents about the risks. And, of course, this was prior to the time that Prozac was even approved by the FDA for children. Dr. Gorman was the president of the Harvard Medical School affiliated McLean University through 2006. He was a professor and chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University, New York through 2002. The New York State Board suspended his license for at least 6 months for, and I quote, inappropriate sexual contact with a patient, unquote. And that occurred on September 30th, 2007. But nonetheless, Gorman received consulting fees from Pfizer, Eli Lilly, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Wyeth Arias, GlaxoSmithKline, Janssen, AstraZeneca, Organon, Forest, Lundbeck, Solvay, Merck, UCB Pharma, Purdue, Aventis, Zenobia. Well, it's about all of them. My goodness. What a success that guy was. Oh, too bad for all the patients, all the people, all the victims. But keep in mind that when you educate yourself, then you can make choices for yourself. Always investigate. Don't look at an authority figure and say, oh, yes, he's got authority. He must be telling me the truth. No. If he's got authority, you want to run away, okay? Dr. Stephen Shon, S-H-O-N, was the co-author of The Factor Structure of the Brief Psychiatric Rating Scale Expanded Version in a Large, Diverse Sample of Psychiatric Patients, partly funded by Forest Laboratories. And Forest makes, they make a lot of product. And in fact, well, I've already talked about that, so let me just move forward. Shon was the medical director of the Texas Department of Mental Health and Mental Retardation in Austin. Shon was also the co-author of Clinician Adherence to Major Depressive Disorder Algorithm in the Texas Public Mental Health Sector. It was sponsored in part by Bristol-Myers Squibb, Eli Lilly, Glaxo, Wellcome, Janssen Pharmaceutica, Novartis, Pfizer, and Wyeth Arias Laboratories. Shon became a co-director of GMAP. Boy, all these connections. And keep in mind that the pharmaceutical industry are the ones that are promoting the idea that so many people have mental problems that they need to have prescriptions for. They need to be medicated. We've got to medicate America. Because only, 25% of America is already medicated. We're just behind schedule. We've got to keep moving forward. The Children's Expert Consensus Panel included Dr. Graham J. Emsley and Dr. Karen Deneen Wagner. Dr. Emsley helped design the TMAP guidelines and participated in two Prozac trials, one of which had negative results. No matter. You just lie about them and get them approved anyway. Emsley, professor and chair, Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, which was a TMAP site, and director of the Bob Smith Center for Research in Pediatric Psychiatry in Dallas. Now, one thing about drugging kids is that they are not aware enough. They don't know how to say how to portray how bad they feel taking the medication. They are the silent victims, and especially the little toddlers. They can't tell their parents how bad these drugs make them feel, which makes them a perfect target for these horrible drug companies, these criminal drug companies. Okay, so Emsley was a consultant and a member of the Speaker's Bureau for Bristol Myers Squibb, Eli Lilly, McNeil, Otsuka, and Wyeth Ayers. He also received grant/research support from Novartis. And of course, when a drug company is paying a doctor who has all these connections in academia, they are looking for a certain conclusion that has to meet with their objective. In other words, the drug company is paying the so-called researcher to find what they want to meet their objectives. Emsley was also a consultant to all of these companies. He was a member of the Speaker's Bureau for McNeil, and these companies funded and sold their drugs to Texas for TMAP. Dr. Karen Deneen Wagner, associated with the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, and her colleagues conducted a study on Pfizer's Zoloft, an SSRI. She told the panel that Zoloft was, and I quote, safe, effective, and well-tolerated in children, unquote. They ought to be in jail. In 1998, based on the consensus opinion of Emsley, Wagner, and others, and without a clinical trial, the TCMAP began using SSRIs on children within the Texas State Juvenile Justice System and the State Foster Care System. Between 1999 and 2003, antidepressant drug prescriptions for children in the United States increased more than 500%, which had tragic consequences. According to JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, Dr. Wagner, a patient advocate, was a consultant to all of these companies. I mean, there's like 10 or 12 companies listed. She was a consultant. And yet she is the same person, the very same person, said, no problem. These drugs are safe. They're safe on the children, especially those children in the juvenile justice system and the foster kids. I mean, nobody's going to care about those kids. Let's just drug them up. The expert consensus panel recommended Paxil, then a new relatively untested drug, to the TCMAP, which was then prescribed for the treatment of children. Dr. Wagner was a consultant for, Paxil, manufactured by GlaxoSmithKline. Paxil has deadly side effects and has been named in a number of lawsuits and is a causal factor among adolescents of several school shootings and was known to cause suicide and homicide ideation. But, hey, if Dr. Wagner said it's good, then Texas went ahead and used it. Oh, gosh. In June of 2003, the FDA finally issued a warning that Paxil should not be prescribed to persons under the age of 18 because of a number of suicides by children taking this drug. The authors of the Viola-Wegerer study, which was done in 1999, warned that dispensing SSRI antidepressants to children and youth whose brains are not fully developed may cause permanent damage to the frontal lobes or irreversible brain dysfunction in the same way that the old-fashioned remedies did. researchers at the Wayne State University School of Medicine evaluated children with obsessive-compulsive disorder before and after taking Paxil. That drug causes brain tissue shrinkage in the thalamus area. Drug-induced brain changes are permanent. Science does not fully understand how the serotonin system functions in the brain. SSRIs disrupt and damage that system. Taking Prozac or other SSRIs is dangerous. It is a chemical thrust into the largely unexplored, unmapped region of life that is your brain. The pharmaceutical industry already developed expensive antidepressants and antipsychotic drugs for an increasing market. TMAP, a protocol for the treatment of mental illness, legitimized the idea of taking drugs and accepting psychological profiling and the expansion of a coercive mental health treatment program. While they initially designed the program for school children, they plan to expand the program to include the people covered by the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA. Critics justifiably claim that TMAP, the drug industry influenced elected officials, claim that through TMAP, the drug industry influenced elected officials to gain access to citizens in prisons and state psychiatric hospitals. The person, critics justifiably claim that through TMAP, the drug industry influenced elected officials, to gain access to citizens in prisons and state psychiatric hospitals. The person primarily responsible for bringing these issues to the public's attention is Alan Jones. In his report, he stated that a political pharmaceutical alliance was the basis of the proposals of the New Freedom Commission as developed in the Texas model. And I'll talk later about the New Freedom Commission, but that was instituted by Bush just after he became president, within just weeks. And that was actually initially developed in Texas, and it was from the Texas model that he developed the New Freedom Commission. And it was specifically to promote the use of newer, more expensive antipsychotics and antidepressants. He also stated that this alliance wanted to create a comprehensive, and I quote, a comprehensive national policy to treat mental illness with expensive, patented medications of questionable benefit and deadly side effects, and to force private insurers to pick up more of the tab, unquote. Hang on. Oh, goodness. All righty. I'm just looking at the chat room here. Vaccines are the first assault on the human body. And they set up the perfect environment, the perfect target group, who can later be prescribed psych drugs because of the consequences of vaccines, which are pretty awful. Anyway, okay, in 1997-98, with funding from Big Pharma, TMAP initiated the TCMAP. They assembled an expert consensus panel to evaluate the most appropriate drugs, the same drugs that they used to treat adults, to treat the mental and emotional problems in children and adolescents. The Texas legislature adopted TMAP by 1999 and passed numerous bills to fund the project's ever-increasing drug costs, including extending Medicaid eligibility to more families so they could purchase high-cost drugs after discharge from institutions. In 1999, TMAP endorsed the use of SSRIs in children considered depressed. Now keep in mind that the SSRIs, particularly Prozac, was not approved by the FDA until January 2003. But TMAP said, oh, go ahead, give it to the kids. Eli Lilly had already conducted a clinical trial of Prozac in children, as well as trials for other drugs. In 2003, the FDA would approve of Prozac for treating depression in children and a provisional approval for GlaxoSmithKline's Paxil. The FDA was also considering Zoloft for children. Newsweek published an article claiming there were 3 million depressed American adolescents to coincide with World Mental Health Day in 2002. The article suggested that these children had an increased risk for career failure, divorce, alcoholism, and suicide, which they could avoid with the new SSRIs, then awaiting approval. It also suggested that failing to provide such medication is akin to withholding an antibiotic from a child who has a life-threatening infection. This is all marketing. It's all marketing. Between 1998 and 2003, doctors in Texas followed the TMAP requirements and prescribed antidepressant drugs to children and most likely would continue to do so. Eli Lilly had two Prozac trials. The second study in 2002 had negative results. After the study's first week, Lilly excluded all of the children who experienced either a bad reaction to Prozac or a good response to the placebo. Out of at least 15 studies, Lilly published only 6. All of the unpublished studies were negative. The published studies for Paxil, Prozac, and Zoloft were manipulated so that negative results were skewed to show positive responses. Actually, the drugs are ineffective and conceal issues or create problems more serious than the initial purpose for the treatment. All righty. Let's see if there are some... Question. Bush and his associates envisioned TMAP as a mental health assessment and treatment model for the entire country. TMAP's 7 stages in strategies for the treatment of major depression is the standard of care for depression as follows. Stage 1, the physician may choose one drug from the approved SSRIs, which include Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, or Celexa, or prescribe another antidepressant such as Wellbutrin, Zyrzone, Effexor, or Remerin. Stage 2. The physician may choose any one of the sertraline, fluoxetine, paroxetine, or citalopram, sustained release, nifazidone, venlafaxine, extended release, or some other tricyclic antidepressant. Stage 3. The physician may choose either a selective NSSRI, the ones that we named, or the sustained-released antidepressants or inhibitors. Stage 4. If the patient has not this is off on one patient. If the patient has not previously tried lithium augmentation, then this would now be tried. If it has been previously tried and failed, then this step would be skipped. If lithium augmentation works, then the patient would continue with it. Stage 5 involves the use of a combination of antidepressants, such as a tricyclic plus an SSRI, an aphazodone plus an SSRI, bupropion, which is a sustained release, plus an SSRI. Basically, most of these include an SSRI, but with other treatment, with other treatments, with other chemicals, with other drugs. Number 6, the patient would receive, if all those drugs fail, then the patient gets to have electroconvulsive therapy. If the patient responds to therapy, then he would continue with treatment. If the patient doesn't respond or only partially responds, then he would proceed to stage 7. Stage 7, at this point, the physician can continue to try different medications or combinations of medications. So this is what you would do to one patient under TMAP, to one of those kids, one of the children that were in the justice system, the juvenile justice system, or one of the, whoops, I forgot to unplug the phone, or in the foster care system in Texas. In other words, they had all of the, that, this is the protocol. This is the algorithm. This is the step-by-step process that a physician would take, these 7 stages. That is what they would do. There would be no talk therapy. No, nothing like that. We're just going to shock them or medicate them, either with 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or whatever. How many ever it takes, that is what we will do. And that was the algorithm. Okay, moving on. Planting another bush at the White House. Many Skull and Bones member families acquired their fortunes through drug trafficking, including the Coffin family, Sloan family, Taft, Bundy, Payne, Whitney, and others. Drug peddling in the 1800s or currently appears to play a significant part in gaining political power, as drug peddlers use politicians to enact laws for compulsory drugs/vaccines while criminalizing natural plants. The drug industry and the federal government collaborate in legalized drug trafficking. Anthony C. Sutton, in describing the Order of Skull and Bones, or the Brotherhood of Death, aptly named, wrote, and I quote, "The activities of the order are directed towards changing our society, changing the world, to bring about a new world order. The elements in society that will require significant focus are education, money, law, politics, economy, history, psychology, philanthropy, medicine, religion, media, and continuity. The power to appoint who follows in your footsteps," unquote. And notice that really happens a lot in politics. I mean, we have you have the same names generation after generation. Anyway, I appreciate Anthony C. Sutton for his work on Skull and Bones, but I find he has failed to talk about other things that are very important. So he's a concealer as much as a revealer. Anyway, and he also states members have infiltrated. He's talking about the Order of Skull and Bones, or the Brotherhood of Death, have infiltrated, and I quote, "just about every significant research, policy, opinion-making organization, in addition to the church, business, law, government, and politics," unquote. And further, I quote, "the most likely potential member is from a Bones family who is energetic, resourceful, political, and probably an amoral team player. A man who understands that to get along, you have to go along. A man who will sacrifice himself for the good of the team. In real life, the thrust of the order is to bring about certain objectives. Honors and financial rewards are guaranteed by the order, unquote. George W. Bush, whose father and grandfather were also members, remarked, and I quote, "My senior year, I joined Skull and Bones, a secret society, so secret I can't say anything more," unquote. George H. W. Bush was the U.N. ambassador from 1971 to 1973. He was the chairman of the Republican National Committee in 1973 to 74, then went to China to oversee the drug trade there in 1974 and 75, followed by a stint as the CIA director in 1976-77. Some researchers maintain that Bush joined the CIA in the early 1950s in order to organize the worldwide narcotics industry, the world's biggest business. Those researchers suggest that the main reason for the invasion of Vietnam was to consolidate the Golden Triangle. Bush was vice president from January 20th, 1981 to January 20th, 1989. On March 23, 1983, President Ronald Reagan created the National Narcotics Border Interdiction System, the NNBIS, and placed it under the direction of Bush. George H.W. Bush. The NNBIS was established to interdict the flow of drugs into the United States. Bush, after he became president, in which he functioned 1989 to 1993, citing a new enemy, declared a well-publicized, highly funded war against drugs, which functioned as the pretext to invade Panama on December 20, 1989. This was to seize Manuel Noriega, who had allegedly been on the CIA's payroll. This invasion killed, according to Panamanian investigators, thousands of poor people. The U.S. government tried Noriega in Miami on 8 counts of drug trafficking, racketeering, and money laundering, and sentenced him to 40 years. Bush popularized the slogan, "Trade, not aid," first used in the 1960s, which was supposed to encourage farmers in third world countries to grow legitimate crops instead of drug-producing crops. This free trade slogan became the kickoff for the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, which led to the outsourcing of American production. In 1990, Bush made the drug problem his top priority. That was when he was president, of course. The first invasion of Iraq occurred on August 2nd, 1990, under Bush, while the second invasion of Iraq occurred under his son, George W. Bush. Warfare puts more people under the authority of the government than almost any other circumstance, especially since 1944, the government and the drug industry have used the military personnel as guinea pigs. The government is one of the industry's biggest customers, if not the biggest. All righty. Let me check real quickly the chat room. All righty. Just let me read a couple comments here. 30 says, people know things are wrong. They just can't put the pieces together to understand it all. Therefore, they don't know how to respond. We are showing them how all the pieces in the puzzle go together. Once they achieve a thorough understanding of what they are up against, they will be able to counter it. Absolutely. And education, I think, is incredibly important. It's essential. And it's essential to know history so that you can piece together what is happening currently. It's absolutely good. Okay, let's see. We have let the parasites fall of their own weight. Regain self responsibility. Whoops. It moved down before I wanted it to. Hang on. Okay. Let the parasites fall where all of their own weight, regain self-responsibility with highest guidance, Find a better way and follow without expectations, only love energy from your heart. Okay, and that's true. We are living in a society where people actually think that they can cure any malady, any feeling. All I have to do is take a pill. And they learn that from the media, from the parents. And so it's up to the parents, too, to set a better standard, to be better models for their children. And Pam Colleen. Somebody said, I started Pam Colleen's nutritional balancing program a few months ago. It is intense. Very good. Okay. Yes, Pam is just a terrific person. We haven't had her on the program for quite some time, but she's very, very invested in the people that she guides, and she's only a phone call away. So if you start her program, she definitely is there all the time to help with whatever issue you might be experiencing. So definitely, I think she's a terrific resource for personal health issues. All righty. Let me check the board. We will take some phone calls. And if you want to make a comment or ask a question, please feel free to call 646-787-1915. Again, that number is 646-787-1915. Okay, back to the Bushes. George W. Bush appointed retired Bristol-Myers Squibb Vice Chairman Bruce Gelb as Chief of the U.S. Information Agency and Ambassador to Belgium. Executives at Bristol-Myers, before the 2000 election of George W. Bush, told lower-level executives to make big donations to the Bush campaign or they would inform CEO Charles Heimbold Jr. The elder Bush was on the Eli Lilly Board of Directors from 1977 to 1979, as was Ken Lay, former Enron CEO, which is very interesting because if you look at the Board of Directors, gosh, excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm talking too much. All righty, take a little drink of my homemade kombucha. And all righty, the Bush family, excuse me, and Eli Lilly had numerous connections. George W. Bush, as president, appointed Lilly CEO Sidney as a Homeland Security Advisory Council member. Terrell is the past president of the Pharma, that's PH, capital RMA, of which all the major drug companies are members. Bush also appointed Mitch Daniels, the former Eli Lilly senior VP in charge of corporate strategy and policy, which he functioned in that capacity 1997 to 2000, as the director of the Office of Management and Budget. Previously, Daniels was Eli Lilly's VP in charge of corporate affairs for 3 years, then president of North American Pharmaceutical Operations. And so he's bringing in all these people from the drug industry. Yes, I know I'm talking too much. Last night, just a diversion here, last night I had an opportunity to be a guest at a book club, a local book club, and they had decided, based on my recommendation, to read my book. And so anyway, I attended the book club meeting, and I was talking quite a bit last night, and I got home about 10:30. But I really, really enjoyed meeting with these ladies and listening to their experiences, and hopefully I was able to share some of my experiences with them. And most of them, I'll say all of them, probably did not understand of the consequences of vaccines. Although one of them is very sharp. She's been studying this on her own and is a non-vaxxer. She just had a baby. And anyway, she's very bright and is really interested in learning more. But I think that's what we must do. That when we have the opportunity to talk to other people about these things that we are learning about, then we absolutely have to share. I mean, don't try and push it down somebody's throat, because that's always going to put them on the defensive. And Mike Walsh said something very important on Monday's program. He said, don't ask them to read a book. Hand them a book and say, I'd really like your opinion about this, because people like to give their opinion. And so if you're inviting them to give their opinion, you're more apt to get them interested in some of the things that you are attempting to explain to them. Anyway, I had ordered a shirt, and it arrived just in time for me to wear it last night. And some other people in the chat room had also ordered this shirt. And it says, I love natural immunity. Stop mandatory vaccination. And so anyway, I was happy to wear my shirt to the meeting last night. And it was very nice. It was in a lovely home. And it was just a very nice environment to share some things that I share with the radio audience. All righty. So anyway, Bush, as soon as he gets in, he just staffs almost his entire administration with top people from the pharmaceutical industry. Now, Eli Lilly enjoyed a rapid growth during Daniel's tenure at the company. Sales of Prozac constituted 30 to 40% of Eli Lilly's income in the mid to late 1990s. Lilly doubled its assets to $12.8 billion and its revenue to $10 billion during that time. Now, and we're talking about Mitch Daniels, and Mitch Daniels was governor of Indiana from 2005 to 2013. And, of course, we all know that Eli Lilly's headquarters are in Indianapolis. They also do business in 17 other countries around the world. So they're interested in profit. And that was kind of our conclusion last night. You know, it's really about profit. When you get right down to it, these companies do not care anything about people. They're in it for the profit. Now, of course, I understand what they do. They have absolutely no idea what goes on in the clinical trials. They're not in the know. They're not part of the upper management that is manipulating things. But they're just clerks and order takers and that kind of thing. So we can't broad brush the entire employee base at Eli Lilly. Okay, in 2002, Senator William H. Frist and Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson recommended Dr. Alastair Wood, professor of clinical pharmacology at Vanderbilt University, as the FDA commissioner. He supported strong regulatory policies by the FDA, which may have disturbed pharmaceutical executives. Bush, with close connections to the drug industry, soon changed his mind, and Dr. Wood was no longer a candidate. Someone quoted Senator Frist, who said, and I quote, there was a great deal of concern that he, Wood, would put too much emphasis on drug safety, unquote. Well, that would have been a shame now, wouldn't it? Frist is not let me tell you about him. Frist, previously a heart and lung transplant surgeon, received $873,000 in contributions from the pharmaceutical industry. Okay, now anyone that has heard my programs with Dr. Paul Byrne and Bernice Jones knows exactly what a heart and lung transplant surgeon does. So we know what kind of a politician that Bill Frist was. And in fact, other people knew about it too. In both 2005 and 2006, he would be named one of the most corrupt members of Congress. He favored the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act and protected the vaccine manufacturers from liability in 4,200 lawsuits. He added a provision into an anti-terrorism bill that would deny compensation to children suffering from vaccine-related brain disorders. It is difficult to get elected to Congress or other political offices without the financial support of pharmaceutical companies. Drug companies control medical schools, the doctors, and the politicians. Dr. Raymond Woolsey, an earlier candidate. Let me check the board and see if anybody's called in. Nope. Okay. Anybody has a question or comment, feel free to call in at 646-787-1915. All righty. Dr. Raymond Woolsey, an earlier candidate for the FDA position, remarked, and I quote, "It is pretty clear that anyone who has said anything that the industry doesn't like isn't going to make it," unquote. Bush chose industry-approved Dr. Mark B. McClellan, son of Carol Keaton McClellan Strayhorn, then comptroller of Texas and a former three-time mayor of Austin. She consistently supported the drug industry and promoted the TMAP program. McClellan assumed the FDA office on November 2002. Mark's brother, Scott McClellan, was Bush's advisor and deputy press secretary. Many individuals, particularly older people, wanted a Medicare prescription drug benefit. Government officials should manage the policies and practices, including price negotiation within the Medicare program, just as other major buyers do. Instead, the drug industry, using its political influence, would not allow a drug benefit that included price negotiations. Congress willingly relinquished its power to transfer in order to transfer billions of extra dollars from taxpayers to the drug companies and pharmacy to the drug companies so that it would benefit big pharma. Isn't that amazing? That Congress has done that a lot. They relinquish a lot of their power and just it's pretty amazing. Now, according to the New York Times, of June 13, 2003, Bush announced policies that would make it easier for drug companies to introduce lower-cost generic versions of prescription drugs, which took effect August 18. Bush said that the FDA would no longer block generics because of patent disputes. Companies would bring generic drugs to the market much more quickly, in some cases years earlier. Under the FDA rules, there was a 30-month delay for each patent infringement suit when the FDA was considering generic versions of the drug. Bush said the law would restrict drug makers to a single 30-month regulatory delay to sort out patent disputes. The Senate bill, sponsored by Charles Schumer, would add prescription drug coverage to Medicare, one of the largest expansions in the government's social safety net in decades. On June 25th, 2003, Representative Dennis J. Hastert, introduced the legislation for the Medicare Modernization Act, MMA, which produced the largest overhaul of Medicare since its establishment on July 30, 1965. Since then, the role of the prescription drugs in patient care has significantly increased. Bush signed it into law on December 8, 2003. This amended Title 18 of the Social Security Act to provide for the voluntary prescription drug benefit under the Medicare program. While this act seems well-meaning, it spells profits for the drug companies. People often exploit something that is ostensibly free. Initially, the net cost of the program was projected at $400 billion for the 10-year period from 2004 to 2013. Ultimately, as of February 2009, the projected net cost of the program over the 2006 to 2015 period was $549.2 billion. With this 2003 Act, the cost of psychiatric medications shifted from the state government to the federal Medicare program with very little oversight from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the CMS. Prescription co-payments are nominal and the taxpayer picks up the tab while the profits go into the portfolios of the pharmaceutical companies. The individual becomes a ward of the state, whether in the prison system, a mental hospital, or outpatient facility, a nursing facility, then they become prime targets, and it is open season for the drug companies. Someone else decides their psychological fate while the drug companies maximize their profits. According to CMS, the Medicare program provided health care services to more than 46 million people in 2001. In 2002, Medicaid enrollees numbered 39.9 million Americans, most of them children, 18.4 million or 46%. 43 million Americans were enrolled in 2004. 19.7 million were children. At a total cost of $295 billion. In 2004, Dr. Mark B. McClellan, who was the head of the became the head of the CMS, and he functioned in that capacity from 2004 to 2006. In that position, he administered the government programs, including Medicare Part D, the Prescription Drug Benefit Program, engendered by the Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modernization Act, signed by Bush on December 8, 2003, as previously mentioned. In 2008, Medicare provided health coverage and services to approximately 49 million low-income children, pregnant women, elderly people, and disabled people. In 2009, 62.9 million Americans were enrolled in Medicaid. Unlike Medicare, a joint federal-state program, the states pick up part of the cost while the federal government pays about 57% of the Medicaid expenses. This is obviously going to reduce the funds for other state-funded projects like infrastructure maintenance. Federal Medicaid expenses were about $204 billion in 2008. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, passed in 2010, provides mental health services and prescription drugs and nursing facility care for those under the age of 21, banding the target group. Okay, let's talk about the people who are on psych drugs. Somebody's talking about a cell phone. Let's see, what are they talking about a cell phone in the chat room? Has anybody heard about how Lark is doing? Okay, you do not want to keep your cell phone next to you at night. In fact, I rarely ever even use my cell phone. Maybe once a month. Revisionism. Somebody asked about how I first found out about revisionism. Well, I do a lot of reading. Okay, let's talk about the people on psych drugs. Okay, according to IMS Health Vector 1, which is a national and total patient tracker, it's a database, and in 2013, these are the figures for just 0 to 1 year olds being prescribed psychiatric drugs. And this is just heartbreaking. All righty. There were 669 children from the age of 0 to 1 year old who were on anti-anxiety drugs such as Xanax, Clonopin, and Ativan. There were 26,406 children under the age of 12 months who were on antidepressants such as Prozac, Zoloft, and Paxil. Oh, goodness. And, I mean, we're talking about babies. We're talking about infants here. Okay, there are 1,422 infants up to the age of 12 months who are taking ADHD drugs such as Ritalin, Adderall, and Concerta. Okay, Ritalin. If you were to take, it's a Schedule II drug, and it is more powerful than cocaine. If you were to snort it or inject it instead of ingest it, it would give you a bigger high, a longer high than cocaine. People who take cocaine are jailed. But doctors, and apparently their parents, feel justified in giving infants under the age of 12 months drugs like Ritalin, Adderall, and Concerta. These are ADH drugs. What stupid people would do this to an infant is beyond me. They should be jailed for abuse. There are 654 up to the age of 12 months who are taking antipsychotics, such as Risperdal, Seroquel, and Zyprexa. The CDC issued a report on the 10,000 2 to 3 year olds being prescribed ADHD drugs. Okay. Apparently, Lark is doing well, and so, okay. Alrighty. He was in somebody's chat room last night. He's apparently still hospitalized, but anyway, bless him, and we hope that he can get out of there soon, quickly, unscathed. Okay. The number of toddlers on anti-anxiety and antidepressants are staggering in comparison. There are 318,997 2 to 3 year olds are on anti-anxiety drugs. There are 46,102 2 to 3 year olds who are taking antidepressants. There are 3,760 2 to 3 year olds who are taking antipsychotics. I'm appalled. Every time I read this, I just can't believe it. People would do this to infants and toddlers. Antipsychotics? Antidepressants? These children should be free to express their to be 2-year-olds, to be 3-year-olds. This is a crime. It's a crime against humanity. Okay, I got to take a deep breath here. Okay. In the other age groups, the numbers start in the millions with 0 to 5-year-olds. The total number of 0 to 5-year-olds currently prescribed psychiatric drugs is 1,080,168. Now, these aren't just people who get a prescription. These are people who fill the prescriptions, and the drug companies keep track of the pharmacies. And if you think that it's bad, it was bad 2 or 3 years ago, by the time all the doctors get all digitized and all the medical records are digitized, they're going to know everything that you're taking, that you're not taking. So you want to stay as far away from allopathic medicine as you possibly can stay. Okay. The number of 6 to 12-year-olds on psychiatric drugs is 4,130,340. The number of 13 to 17-year-olds taking psychiatric drugs is 3,617,593. In 2001, just after Bush took office, the United States spent $85 billion just on mental health care. In 2008, that sales figure had increased to $170 billion, straight into the pockets of the pharmaceutical industry. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the doctor that appeared on Fox News after the shooting yesterday, within hours, I don't know, five hours. She said, oh, this country needs more mental health care. It needs more mental health care. Okay. In 2008, I said the figure was $170 billion. By 2015, this year, experts expect that this spending will increase to $280 billion. The taxpayer, through Medicaid and Medicare, pays almost 60% of the nation's cost for mental health care. So, as you are traveling around your city and you see the bridges are crumbling and the roads are crumbling and all this stuff is happening, you can blame it on Medicaid, because your state, your county, cannot afford to keep the infrastructure up to date, because most of the money is going to mental health care. And I've given these figures before, but I'm going to do it again. As of April 2014, the number of people taking psychiatric drugs in the United States is as follows. ADHD drugs, 10,291,860. Antidepressants, 41,226,394. Antipsychotics, 6,845,303. Anti-anxiety, 36,472,663. Okay, all psychiatric drugs equals 78,694,222. The estimated population of the United States as of August 15th was 321,522,000, which means that about 25% of the entire population is on psych drugs. There's going to be consequences for this. You can't avoid it. There's going to be more road rage. There's going to be more suicides. And we don't hear about the individual suicides. We don't hear about the stories of road rage. I mean, just in the Chicago area, there have been people who have been target practicing on the highways and shooting people in their cars. Where does all this behavior come from? Where does the domestic violence come from? Why are there 8,000 people, military personnel, even those who have not been deployed? Why is it that 8,000, at least 8,000 of those people commit suicide each and every year? It used to be that if you had any kind of mental condition, that you were not viable. They did not consider you viable to be in the military. They rejected you. And now, military, the psychiatrists associated with the military, are prescribing cocktails of these psychiatric drugs. They are promoting screening. Now, anytime that you get screened for whatever, whether you're talking about a mammography, whether you're talking about anything you get screened for, a mental disease, they are going to find something wrong. That's the whole purpose of screening. They're not preventing illnesses. They are trying to find something that they can give you a prescription drug for, or cut you open, or radiate you, or give you chemotherapy. It is not to help you. It is to help the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry and the allopathic industry is a for-profit industry. They are in it for profit. They are not there to help the patient. They do not cure patients. They treat them. In fact, doctors are not even supposed to mention the word cure. They are treating you. And we all know that thousands upon thousands of people die each year from via allopathic medicine, at least 900,000. And these are figures directly from the government. This is not something that somebody just made up. These are figures straight from the government, their admissions. And yet we never hear anything like this about this on TV. Well, for a good reason. It's pharmaceutical industries that do most of the advertisements on TV. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me today. And join me on Saturday. And anyway, thanks. Have a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful day. Thanks.
Starts with you and me.
Starts with you and me.